Today's monthly jobs report from the Labor Department marked the end of 10 years of job growth in this country. More than 700,000 jobs were lost, and that's probably just the beginning. We're joined now by Mohammed El Arian, Chief Economic Advisor at Allianz and President-elect of Queen's College, Cambridge. Mohammed El Arian, always nice to speak with you.
Wonderful to be back. Thank you.
Well, and how long do you think that this economic downturn is going to last, and how bad will it get?
We don't know. We all want to have an answer to that critical question, and we simply don't know. It's not an economic issue. It's not a financial issue. It's a medical issue.
It's a medical issue right now, but could it become an economic issue down the road, even if the coronavirus gets under control? A lot of people have been laid off. Maybe not all of them will be hired back, and people will have a problem going out into restaurants or to sporting events or any conferences that people get together. Isn't that going to have a lasting effect?
It will, and there's three elements to what you just said. And I think each of them is challenging, and the three together show why this is truly a generation-defining moment. The first one is simply navigating what is a massive hit to everything we do, and that will result, unfortunately, in a lot of bankruptcies and, unfortunately, in the sorts of unemployment rates that we have never seen before. The second element is that the restart is not just flicking on a switch. There's a notion that once we get the all clear from the medical side, we're simply going to flick a switch and the economy is going to operate again. It's not. It is very complicated to get an economy that has been subjected to a sudden stop back on track. And then the third element is that the landscape post-crisis is going to look very different. We're going to have the following. One is a major hit to productivity and therefore growth potential. Second, we're going to have much higher debt and a much greater entanglement of the public sector in private sector activities. That is almost inevitable. Third, we're going to have question marks about institutional robustness and effectiveness. Fourth, we're going to deglobalize the economy at a faster rate. And that leads to the fifth theme, which is we're going to go from a focus on efficiency, just-in-time delivery, to resilience. Let's build resilience into the system.
Give me an example of what you mean by that, building resilience into the system instead of efficiency.
So we're coming from a world in which companies really had really bought into global supply chains because you can minimize cost, just-in-time inventory management, because that lowers how much cash you have to put out to carry your inventory. And now they've realized that if there's a shock to that system, it's a question of survival. And the shock really started to sink in with the trade war. And now, with what first happened in China and what's happening today, people realize that we should have a home bias. We should bring things home. And we should build in resilience in every element that we can manage. And that's not just going to be about companies. It's going to be about us.
Are you worried about a shock to our financial system? If businesses cannot pay back their loans, could banks all of a sudden see a wave of defaults and then we have a banking problem as well?
Monday, a few weeks ago, we came very close to market failure. But the Fed, with the support of the Treasury, moved in and addressed in a very laser-focused way these market failures. So I don't worry about the whole system freezing up. But you raise an important point. This shock, unlike 2008, did not start in finance. It started in the real economy. But it's starting to undermine finance. And if you're in a bank, let me make it very simple. If you're in a bank, you have a real dilemma ahead of you. On the one hand, you should lend because a lot of your clients are facing short-term problems. And if you withhold new financing, you risk turning short-term problems that are temporary and reversible into long-term solvency issues. Liquidity problems become solvency. So that collective interest and the interest of your client tells you lend. But if you're safeguarding your balance sheet and your business, and you don't know how long this is going to last, is it going to last 3 months? Is it going to last six months? That calls for you to be cautious. And every bank right now is facing that dilemma. We are trying through Federal Reserve measures to align both collective and individual incentives, but it's proving to be very hard. So let me take an example of a small business. They have no earnings to speak of. If you're a restaurant right now, you want to keep on your people, but you can't pay them. So this dilemma, and we face it as individuals. Why did we collectively empty out the shelves for certain products? Not because it's in our collective interest, but we were selfish. So it is very hard when people are taken out of their comfort zone in such an abrupt and violent manner to align both individual and collective incentives. It's a shame because we are collectively in this and we collectively get out of it together, not through individual actions, but it's hard.
We have got so much going on in the world's biggest economies. This virus came out of China, the second largest economy. Now the epicenter is the United States, the biggest economy. Europe is a mess right now. What about countries that we're not spending that much time talking about? How worried are you about the emerging markets of the world? Turkey, Argentina, South Africa, Brazil, places like that.
I'm not just worried, I'm terrified. First, the healthcare system there is weak. It will be overwhelmed very quickly, which means, unfortunately, people dying, and people dying in much larger numbers than we've seen so far. Second, to protect the rest of the population, governments will try to do exactly what we are doing. The notion of governments are all in, whatever it takes. The problem is we can afford it. Many of these countries cannot afford it. So while they will understandably follow our footsteps in going all in for relief, pretty soon the reality of their situation is going to catch up with them.
What do you think the United States should do from an economic standpoint? We've already got three packages, including the $2 trillion relief package just passed. Now there's talk of another multi-trillion dollar package involving infrastructure. But there are already some signs, especially from Republicans, of hesitancy about putting the U.S. even more into trillions more in debt. What do you think that the U.S. ought to do?
So first, it's not surprising that we're seeing hesitancy. Typically, you get what's called adjustment fatigue. People are tired. You know, you want me to do all this all over again? The reality is that it's not enough to design programs. You have to implement them. And we need to find faster ways to get money to people who are in real pain. And people are in real pain right now. We also have to have principles. So one thing that I think I'm worried about is we have started bailing out certain sectors, the airlines, Boeing, without answering very basic questions. Why are we doing this? When are we doing it? How are we doing it? And how are we going to exit? On what terms? And the reason why it's important is because the airlines and Boeing aren't the exception. They are just the leading indicator of a massive supply and demand destruction, consumption and production, that's hitting industry after industry. So we need to develop general principles instead of just going ad hocly one company or one sector after the other.
Income inequality was a major problem well before COVID-19. It's gotten worse over the last many decades. But do you think that in a post-COVID world, it's going to be even worse than it was before? You already see sort of the velvet rope economy developing, where some people can get the care that they need. They can be in a situation in isolation that's more pleasant than others. And then there are so many people who don't either have health insurance, maybe they're afraid to go to the hospital if they have symptoms, et cetera. What is it going to look like on the other side?
So if we don't do anything about it, we are going to see the inequality, not just of income, but of opportunity get a lot worse. And that concerns me, and it should concern every American, because that's the basis of the social contract. And as I tell people over and over again, and this applies to corporations when it comes to social responsibility, you cannot be a good house in a bad neighborhood. You just can't. How good your house is also a function of a neighborhood. And the neighborhood we all live in, no matter whether we're in a good house or a bad house, has been hit hard. And we will need an element of collective responsibility to address the neighborhood. Otherwise, everybody's going to converge towards the bottom as opposed to people converging towards the top.
That is Mohammed El Arian, who is the chief economic advisor to Allianz and president-elect of Queen's College, Cambridge. Fascinating to hear your thoughts on this. Mohammed El Arian, thank you so much for joining us.
Jeremy, thank you for having me. I really love conversations with you.